Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
A debate on gun control and safety is heading back to Tallahassee, whether it's sooner or later. Some are wondering if there will ever be an agreement between the warring factions.
I'll have a very keen eye on how we can accomplish the objective of preserving liberties for law-abiding citizens and simultaneously preventing violence in our community.
Also this week, guns are controversial, so is school choice, and fears are building that Florida's Commissioner of Education is stacking the deck against traditional public schools.
You know, I met several months ago with the Commissioner of Education, and he made no bones about it. He doesn't see anything wrong with cutting our public school system in the state of Florida by two-thirds.
We'll also continue the controversy as we speak with the guy who wrote the bill that some say hobbled the felon's voting amendment. And on a related note, can a convicted felon run for political office? I'm Tom Flanagan. Welcome to Capitol Report. Florida lawmakers have until Tuesday of next week to say whether they support a special session on firearms legislation. Democrats have called for the move, but 60% of the lawmakers in both chambers would have to back it, an unlikely outcome in the state's GOP-controlled legislature. Regan McCarthy has more.
Coral Gables Democratic Representative Javier Fernandez is one of the lawmakers behind the call for a special session on gun safety. He says his caucus is pushing common sense ideas he thinks most people could get behind.
We could have put on a lot of other hot button gun reform issues, gun buybacks, or mandatory gun buybacks, or an assault weapons ban. That was not the intent of this call. The intent was to highlight some areas of gun reform where I think there is, and we think as a caucus, there is widespread community support in all parts of the state, gun owners, non-gun owners.
Fernandez says the goal is to help improve safety.
We do have to acknowledge, and we've got data to back it, that when we have reduced access to guns, there are fewer homicides, period.
But not everyone agrees.
There's no evidence or facts to show that concealed weapons permit holders are dangerous in any way. In fact, they make places more safe by literally just being there because a responsible law-abiding citizen, proficient in the use of firearms, makes a place more safe.
Claremont Republican Representative Anthony Sabatini says Democrats are pushing bills he says won't improve safety, but could prevent people from being able to protect themselves.
But one thing that won't prevent mass shootings are these ideas being pushed by Democrats like gun control, banning guns based on their shape, background checks for people who sell them at gun shows. It's not going to actually prevent. They're really a complete and total distraction. And what makes that conversation so bad is that it distracts from an actual conversation, a healthy conversation about how to prevent mass shootings.
Those debates appear to be heading to committees in Tallahassee. Lawmakers have already filed several pairs of dueling bills, which will likely filter through the Criminal Justice Committee. Tampa Republican Representative James Grant chairs the committee in the House.
As the committee chairman where all of this stuff is referenced, I'll have a very keen eye on how we can accomplish the objective of preserving liberties for law-abiding citizens and simultaneously preventing violence in our community.
Grant says as committee meetings start in the next few weeks, he hopes to put bills on the agenda that strike that balance. I'm Regan McCarthy.
Florida Education Commissioner Richard Corcoran isn't shy about his support for charter schools and the state's private school voucher program. He championed school choice policies during his stint in the legislature, but his placement as chief of the state's education system is beginning to worry public school leaders. Recent comments about the future of public education has raised alarm bells for supporters of traditional public schools, and we got that story from Lynn Hatter.
When Richard Corcoran was Speaker of the House, he pushed through an aggressive expansion of charter schools and voucher programs. When Governor Ron DeSantis named Corcoran to lead the state's public school system, traditional school advocates worried about what that would mean. Florida had about 2.8 million kids enrolled in public schools last year. Now, though, Leon County Superintendent Rocky Hanna worries those fears are being validated.
You know, I met several months ago with the Commissioner of Education, and he made no bones about it. He doesn't see anything wrong with cutting our public school system in the state of Florida by 2/3.
Corcoran couldn't be reached for comment. Sam Abrams leads Columbia University's nonpartisan Center for the Study of Privatization in Education.
Well, it's certainly about choice. The policymakers who push for charters and vouchers do believe that parents should have more choice. This goes all the way back to 1955 when Milton Friedman made this argument, an essay called The Role of Government in Education. And libertarians in particular have been beating this drum ever since.
While charter schools in Florida are considered public schools, they're still privately managed. Florida had about 296,000 students enrolled in charters in the 2017-18 school year. Another 108,000 attended private schools through the Corporate Tax Scholarship Program. School choice supporters often point to studies showing those students do better than their traditional school counterparts. And that's been the argument in Florida now for years.
If you get better results from charter schools, you have to look at those results quite carefully. There's screening going on. And that means that underperforming students aren't getting in there in the first place. They can be counseled out. You have to ask yourself, what is the impact of a concentration of underperforming students, especially students with emotional behavioral problems, in public schools? That ultimately, I think, is the primary problem with all of this choice, is you're going to have severe segregation.
And Abrams says that's bad for the quality of education systems unless there are significant controls. Take the Netherlands, for example.
The Netherlands, of all places, which has a strong welfare state with approximately 70% of their students using vouchers. But all the teachers have to be certified. The curricula have to comport with national standards, meaning no teaching of creationism in science classes, for example. And the teacher salaries are on a ladder, a national ladder, so you can't drive down teacher salaries, which is often the case where you have charter schools and private schools funded by vouchers because the teachers don't have to be certified, so that drives down salaries.
Schools in the Netherlands have registration, not admissions offices, meaning they can't discriminate or cherry-pick students. And that's been a constant source of criticism against such schools in Florida. Abrams says there's little dispute over whether privatization in public education gives parents more choice. It does. But he notes teachers and schools often come out on the losing end, something teachers unions like the Florida Education Association have railed about for years.
We have folks that are in our legislature that are talking about charter schools and voucher schools. They're trying to create a parallel school systems. And this is the have and the have-nots. We've seen this before prior to Brown versus Board of Education.
Fed Ingram heads the FEA.
And so we're telling this legislature, and we've been telling them for the better part of two decades, that one, your accountability system is not working for black and brown children. It is labeling them in a way that is negatively impacting their opportunity, their hope, and their families. This is far beyond math and science. This has had a subliminal effect on business and commerce and housing. And so we're resegregating our entire fabric in the state of Florida by this advent of charters and vouchers and private schools.
Earlier this year, choice advocates scored a major win in a long-running lawsuit. At issue was whether the Florida legislature is upholding a constitutional mandate to adequately fund a safe and high-quality system of public education. The group Citizens for Strong Schools argued Florida is funding two separate systems of public education through its use of charter schools and the private school scholarships. They said such programs take money away from traditional public schools, but the courts ruled there was no correlation between funding and student performance on national measures. While Commissioner Corcoran envisions a system where most students attend charter and private schools, Leon County Superintendent Rocky Hanna wonders what happens to those students who are left behind.
As you expand these vouchers and charter schools, they're only going to slowly bleed to death our traditional public schools. And as resources go away, it makes it harder for us to serve kids, especially those with special needs, which a lot of these private schools, they don't have to abide by the same rules that we do because they're not sending them federal money. They're just sending them state money. But for us, money's money.
Choice advocates point out the state's corporate tax scholarships largely go to minority students, seemingly countering the segregation narrative. And while the number of students in a district may fall, the district's costs don't, leading to crumbling schools, budget cuts, and program losses. Florida's schools are already resegregating as families flock to schools and zip codes perceived to be better. And that loss, says Columbia University's Abrams, only amplifies segregation.
They're taking with them their voice for better teacher pay, smaller classes, microscopes and computers in classrooms, more science labs. They're taking with them what I call their countervailing voice for such improvements.
A 2017 study out of the Leroy Collins Center notes Florida's path toward the resegregation of public schools. And it comes at a time when the state's corporate tax scholarship program could soon top $1 billion, while traditional public schools continue to serve the vast majority of the state's students. I'm Len Hatter.
Still to come on Capitol Report, the lawmaker who wrote the enabling bill for Amendment 4, the one allowing most felons to vote, talks about the whys and wherefores of his legislation.
One of the things I said from day one with the constitutional amendment is it's very different when we're talking about implementing what was presented to the voters.
After pleading guilty to federal corruption charges, a former Tallahassee City Commissioner's name is still on the ballot for next year's state Senate election. So now what?
Since he's pled guilty, essentially, he's convicted of a felony, and he will not be on the voter rolls much longer.
And if the state of Florida no longer provides incentives for TV and movie producers to do business here, maybe cities and counties can do it instead.
You look at state or regional incentives as a mitigating factor against your budget. How much am I going to get back for the dollars that I'm going to spend?
Florida voters approved a constitutional amendment allowing some felons to regain the right to vote. Early estimates predicted nearly 1.5 million felons would qualify. A new law regarding the amendment cuts that figure by half. Both the amendment and the law say felons should repay court-ordered restitution, fines, and fees before they can register to vote. The American Civil Liberties Union has sued, claiming the requirements are a poll tax, something that's banned under the U.S. Constitution. Now, a judge is asking, if that's the case, whether the amendment itself could be unconstitutional. Capitol reporter Blaise Ganey caught up with Tampa Republican Representative Jamie Grant, who drafted the enabling bill for the amendment, to get his thoughts.
Grant says his approach to writing Amendment 4's implementing bill was different from writing a bill he made from scratch because he had to follow guidelines.
One of the things I said from day one with the constitutional amendment is it's very different when we're talking about implementing what was presented to the voters.
Grant says he stuck to the words presented to voters on paper, but others spoke more about what they thought was in voters' minds.
The reality is we don't know what different voters were thinking. What I know in my office, I can just tell you from correspondence, I had people who reached out and said, any financial obligation, that's not what I voted for. I voted for prison time. I simultaneously had people reach out and they said, no, I voted for when the term of the sentence is completed, and that means restitution and fines and fees.
Some have raised concerns that Grant's implementing bill violates the U.S. Constitution because it requires felons to pay back fines, fees, and restitution before regaining the right to vote. But Grant maintains he took that language from the amendment voters passed.
If our bill is a poll tax in violation of the 24th Amendment, then even at the strictest construction, Amendment 4 is a violation of the 24th Amendment, because I think what most people don't realize is probation is inherently a financial obligation.
But Grant doesn't think either is unconstitutional, and he thinks the argument diminishes what the United States 24th Amendment did.
The historical atrocity of a poll tax was something that said somebody who didn't commit a crime, somebody who did nothing wrong, somebody who was just poor or a minority, was denied access to the ballot box. That is inherently different than somebody who committed a felony convicted through due process.
A judge has asked lawyers to consider whether both the new law and amendment violate the U.S. Constitution. Grant says that's thanks to the ACLU's challenge against implementing the bill.
The ACLU has now done an about-face to go file a federal lawsuit completely contradicting their prior position.
Grant points to a letter the ACLU sent in December of 2018 to then-Secretary of State Ken Detzner, acknowledging financial obligations could include restitution and fines imposed as part of a sentence or probation. I'm Blaise Ganey.
even though there are still lots of uncertainties when it comes to Florida felons voting, there shouldn't be too much debate when it comes to whether or not a convicted felon, especially one who might be facing significant prison time, should be running for elected office. Well, former Tallahassee City Commissioner Scott Maddox has been removed from that office by Governor Ron DeSantis. Maddox pleaded guilty to federal corruption charges, but the one-time state Democratic Party chair remains an active candidate for a state senator seat. Ryan Daly spoke with several elections experts about what would bar candidates from getting onto a ballot.
People look to Bill Monford for the best wisdom they can have when it comes to education policy. He'll be sorely missed in the Florida legislature.
That's former state legislator and current Florida State University president John Thrasher talking about Democratic Senator Bill Monford, whose term in seat 3 is up in 2020. There are 5 candidates filed with the State Division of Elections vying to replace him. Among them is Scott Maddox, who just weeks ago pleaded guilty to federal extortion and tax fraud charges.
The government dismissed 39 of the 42 counts Mr. Maddox was charged with, and he accepts responsibility for the things he did do wrong, but he wants to move on for his life, his family's life, and Tallahassee, and he hopes Tallahassee heals.
That's Maddox's lawyer, Stephen Dobson, speaking immediately after his client's guilty plea. But even with Maddox listed as an active candidate, it appears becoming a state senator won't be part of his moving on.
Mr. Maddox is filed as a candidate for state Senate seat three. He has not qualified because the qualifying period hasn't begun. It's a 1-week period. That'll be later next year.
Leon County Elections Supervisor Mark Early explains to qualify, candidates have to pay a fee and file financial disclosure documents.
But really, there's nothing to prevent him from qualifying, you know, as long as he can get there and file the papers and all of that. Statutorily, the requirements kick in when you actually take office.
Maddox is facing a maximum of 45 years in prison on the 3 charges he pleaded guilty to and will be sentenced in November, making it unlikely he'd show up in person to qualify. But even if Maddox did, Early says, the former commissioner wouldn't be able to take office anyway.
I believe one of the requirements for that seat is to be a registered voter or to have your voting rights in effect. And as now, since he's pled guilty, essentially, he's convicted of a felony, and he will not be on the voter rolls much longer.
Early isn't the qualifying officer for Senate seat 3. That's under the Department of State. Though DOS did not return multiple requests for interview. Stetson University law professor Chara Torres-Spellacy specializes in election law. She says in theory, there is a long shot out for candidates who are in a position like Maddox's.
Ambiguity about how long they can actually stay on the ballot, but you know, should a convicted felon quote win the election, they can't be seated in a office in Florida under the Florida Constitution unless a governor actually pardons them. But if you're talking about a federal crime, you would actually have to have a pardon from the president to get rid of a federal crime.
Maddox was once the youngest mayor Tallahassee had ever seen, and his political star rose to the level of statewide Democratic Party chair. It's unlikely he'd receive a pardon from President Donald Trump. I'm Ryan Daly.
The city of Jacksonville was once known as the Hollywood of the South because of all the motion pictures that were shot there. Numerous films and TV shows have been filmed in Florida through the years, from Burn Notice and Miami Vice to The Truman Show and Scarface. The state used to entice producers with financial incentives, but that program ended a few years ago, and many productions set in Florida have moved elsewhere. But some of the state's largest counties are now offering their own incentives, as we hear from Bradley George.
You don't think I'm strong enough?
I don't know if you're cruel enough.
Powerful men don't have to be cruel.
Tampa's Ybor City neighborhood was the setting for Ben Affleck's 2016 gangster film Live by Night. The film was a flop. It lost over $75 million, and not a single frame was shot in Tampa. Affleck, who also directed, decided it would be cheaper to recreate Ybor in Brunswick, Georgia. That's because films and TV shows shot in Georgia can apply for a 30% rebate on money they spend in the state. Florida started its own incentive program in the early 2000s, but it ran out of money in 2014.
We were number three in the United States as far as location filming while we had that incentive program at the state level.
Tyler Martin-Luck is commissioner of Film Tampa Bay, which promotes film and TV production in Hillsborough County.
Since that program has ended, we're not even in the top 20 anymore.
Hillsborough and five other Florida counties now offer their own incentives. If a movie shoots in Tampa, producers can get a 10% rebate if they spend at least $100,000.
That could be spent a number of ways. It could be hotel rooms, payroll for local residents. It could be renting your equipment or going to the Home Depot here in town and buying lumber.
Martin Locke says the incentive works well for independent films or TV commercials.
But 10% isn't going to attract Avengers, right, when they can go to Georgia and get 30% or more.
Pinellas County offers a 10% rebate of its own, but it also requires filmmakers to participate in tourism marketing. Director Tim Burton recorded this testimonial for his 2016 film, Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children.
There's so much things to offer here. You know, there's so many different vibes and different scenarios and different looks and things, and it's a good place to shoot.
Tony Stopperan is producing an upcoming thriller starring Katherine Heigl and Harry Connick Jr. He made the film using incentives from Pinellas, Hillsborough, and Sarasota counties.
They're baked into a budget. From a producing standpoint, you look at state or regional incentives as a mitigating factor against your budget. How much am I going to get back for the dollars that I'm going to spend?
Stopperan says the county incentives were a key reason he decided to keep the production in Florida. But he says the lack of a statewide incentive program restricts where he can film.
As a producer, I shouldn't have to limit the productions that I do to those that are showcasing the beautiful beaches and downtowns of the Tampa Bay, Sarasota area.
Multiple attempts at reviving the state incentive program have gone nowhere. The latest proposal would give filmmakers grants of up to $2 million if most of a project is shot in Florida and employs local crew members. But the bill died at the end of the legislative session. Many of the legislature's most powerful members, including Republican House Speaker Jose Oliva, are opposed to incentives. He's called them corporate welfare. Philip Suderman with the conservative group Americans for Prosperity spoke against the bill.
Instead of corporate welfare handouts involving taxpayer dollars that will almost certainly provide poor returns, government should offer pro-market solutions for economic growth, such as removing unnecessary regulations and fees that can hinder a firm's ability to operate.
While the future of state incentives is uncertain, Hillsborough County commissioners are considering offering more to filmmakers. The county's incentives are capped at $500,000 a year. I'm Bradley George in Tampa.
You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, we'll wrap up this edition of Capitol Report on a musical note. What makes a musical instrument priceless? Some might say it's a combination of age and craftsmanship. People who have spent their lives making music might think differently. WLRN's Christine DeMatte brings us the story of two South Florida musicians born more than seven decades apart, but bound by a shared love of one special instrument.
It was lunchtime, and Merlin Orkey had just walked into a diner he didn't normally go to.
I jumped on a stool at the counter and waited for the waitress. And
he noticed a teenage boy and a middle-aged man at the same counter looking over some sheet music. His kind of music.
A violin score. Looked like a violin concerto.
He grabbed my shoulder and he said, "Are you a violinist?" And I said, "Yeah, I am."
Gabriel Esperon was 16, and he had just come back from performing at a music festival. He was sitting in the diner with his coach, going over his repertoire for the coming season, when Orkey approached them.
And he told me, "I've been waiting for over 20 years for God to send me a violinist to bestow my violin to."
Orkey is 89 years old. He put his own professional career as a violinist aside after his wife passed away. She was a pianist. He says the two had been a team since they got married in the early 1950s. His violin was stored out of sight.
I have kept it sort of on the top shelf of my closet, hoping that someday I would find just the right person that would appreciate it. And needed it.
I was just in shock.
Gabriel's own violin wasn't all that great. He bought it with money he earned busking on downtown Fort Lauderdale street corners. And now suddenly, here was this total stranger, a seasoned musician, offering his own instrument for free. It all seemed too good to be true. And what was this guy's name again?
Merlin. Like the magician Merlin.
The two arranged to meet later that very day at Orky's home. Gabriel brought along his coach, Eric Birkin.
By its shape, I knew it was something special. The first impression I had is it had to be German because it's so dark, and the German violins are generally darker wood. I checked the label inside, and it said Johann Stephan Thompard, and I knew the name, and said 1800. I tried to make him an offer for it.
But Orky wouldn't hear of it. He simply handed the instrument over to this teenage musician.
And then I tuned it up, and I played a couple notes.
I shuddered. I almost cried when I heard the sound that came out of the violin and what he was playing.
The Mendelssohn Violin Concerto in E minor, a composition Orky had first learned a long, long time ago. It all seemed too good to be true. And what was this kid's name again?
Gabriel. He plays like an angel.
And that brings us to something else these two have in common. For decades, Orky and his wife had played with the music ministries of several churches. Ask him what place faith has in his life, and he'll give you back just one word.
Everything.
Gabriel plays with a youth string ensemble connected with an Episcopal church. The kids donate all the proceeds from their concerts to a food truck that feeds the homeless. In the year since the two violinists first met, Merlin Orky has become a regular at every one of the youth ensemble's concerts. He usually takes a seat in one of the back rows, watching a 17-year-old draw intensity and subtlety out of his old violin. Except he no longer refers to it as his, or even Gabriel's. Considering that chance encounter in the diner, Orky can't help thinking that a certain third party is the violin's true owner.
You know, if you've been in the music ministry and you and your family have been dedicated to it, all they have and all they own is a gift to you from the Lord. So I say it's his fiddle.
I'm Christine DiMattei in Miami.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Daly, Blaise Ganey, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, and Regan McCarthy. Thanks also to Bradley George and Christine DiMatti. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Ken Smith, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Be sure to join us again next week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. For more information about Capitol Report and to hear previous episodes, visit WFSU.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org.